Excuse me. Recordings has now started. Please proceed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the Translation and Transliteration of Contact Information PDP Working Group on Thursday, the 13th of November, 2014. On the call today, we have Chris Dillon, Yubel Sethikath, Rudy Van Snick, Petter Reinforth, Hitanan Kormorn-Patana, Amr Elzdar, Jennifer Chung, and Emily Taylor. We have an apology from James Gelvin. From staff, we have Lars Hoffman, Amy Bivens, and myself, Terry Agnew. I would like to remind all participants to please state their name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and back over to you, Chris.
Thank you very much. Okay, we've managed to get Adobe Connect to display both the draft document and the comments. We probably won't display the agenda because we're using just completely standard agenda, but Emma's writing, it's very clever. Yes, we were rather pleased with that. Very convenient. So I'll just have a quick look at the sort of standing items. So statements of interest is, I have to ask officially whether there has been any change since our last meeting. Seeing nothing in the chat room and hearing nothing, I think we can then move on. And as I suggested a moment ago, the main thing on the agenda today is the discussion of various comments we've had in the last since we last met, we've got them displaying on the screen, and so I'll just so that we're in more or less the right place. So for those of you who've got paper copies of the document, I think we'll be round about page 11. That's the sort of key area. Pace less speed. There we are. This looks more or less right. And so what I'll just be doing is, does not behave like paper. Okay. So basically I'll just be working through various comments that have come in. So we've got several comments from an email that Emily Taylor sent, and we'll just be going through those. And sometimes we have mentioned some of the issues in previous calls, and sometimes perhaps we haven't. The hope is that next time we release a draft version, that we can reflect the comments that have come in. Before I plunge into them, I've made that point. So we can actually start with the first comment up here at the top, which is talking about costs. Now, let's see if I'm clever enough to get us down to page 12. Heavens, we're on page 21. How did that happen? This looks good. This is more or less right. Okay, so we may be referring to some text here. And we have... This comment about the externalization of transformation costs to registrars. This is something we have spoken about before, that often mandatory transformation is mentioned, it's not really very clear where the costs will end up, there is a possibility of moving of costs. I mean, the only comment here I would say is it's not just to registrars, it could be to other entities as well, so registrants, registries on occasion. I think all of that is possible, and also often a particular actor is specified, so the idea is that somebody could have costs, but the strong suspicion is that that actor may actually pass the costs on to somebody else. So it's quite a complicated matrix. Amr, would you like to pick up something on this topic?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. This is Amr. I think it is noteworthy here to not just point out that there's going to be a shifting of costs from one actor to another, but also to point out that there will be significantly more costs incurred because of this policy. If this policy doesn't exist, then whether it's law enforcement agency, IP attorneys, or any other person who wants to do a whois lookup and is required to and has to do a transformation of the contact information, that's on a case-by-case basis. But what this policy will effectively do is require contracted parties or registrants to transform all the data, whether this data is actually needed to be transformed or not. So I think it's not just a matter of shifting costs, but it's actually a lot more costs. I mean, a lot of money spent unnecessarily, actually. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Yes, now that's an aspect of it I think we have to some extent covered. That was why I was scrolling the document up. There are several paragraphs starting at the bottom of page 12. Accurate transformation is very expensive. It may be that we actually need to develop this point rather more. It's already a long point, but it may be that we need to add some elements to it. But certainly, there is a suspicion that transformation does make things more expensive. Emily, would you like to pick up something there?
Thank you very much, Chris. And I just wanted to state my agreement with what Amr just said. And I think, to my mind, there's two closely related issues bound up in this. One is the cost itself, and I think you're right. We have got some acknowledgement of that on that bullet point at the bottom of page 12. The other issue is that Amr mentioned is proportionality and the fact that a mandatory policy will affect all whois data, however many hundreds of millions of records. And it's not quite clear whether that is a proportionate response to the need that's been expressed. And so I think that perhaps if we're expanding in that area, that proportionality is something that we can address. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. And I should thank you again, or use this opportunity to thank you again for the work you've done, both in summarising other people's comments and also adding your own. I mean, it's a very substantial contribution. I'll just say something about proportionality. I can see Petter's just put his hand up, but I'll just mention proportionality. You read my mind. I think the next thing I was going to do was to add something about that to this same bullet point. So it's getting this bullet point is getting slightly out of control, but I think certainly it needs to be reflected. We did have in earlier versions of things that we discussed, we did talk about this issue, but I think it would be good to add it somewhere, and this bullet point is one possibility for that. Petter, would you like to bring something up?
Thanks, Petter Ringford here. Just about the costs, I think we can One of the few things we all can agree about is actually that it will be extra costs. But what you say is that it cannot be put on one single participant, so to speak. What many of you think is okay, that I don't think is okay, is to push all these extra costs on the user that wants to have some kind of globally readable WHOIS information. So what I want to see as a final solution is, yes, there will be extra costs. We have to split it on the registrars and registrants and also the end users in a decent way. Thanks.
Thank you, Petter. Thank you very much for that. When I was making rather a clumsy point earlier on in the discussion about actors, I think this was really the way my mind was working. So there is a bit of a suspicion that that actually a lot of costs could end up with registrants. You know, all I would like to say is that in a situation like this, where there will be extra costs, it's very important that one particular group of actors doesn't end up carrying everybody else effectively. That there has to be some way of stopping that, and I think a little bit further. I think a little bit later, there are specific suggestions about how that may work. And I think this version of the document doesn't have anything about that, but we may well be wanting to add something. All right, so unless there's anything else about costs, I'll just double check we've not missed anything. So we've got contracted parties are justified by benefits to others. Yes, I think we've picked that up. And here we go. In fact, I thought it was further down the list, but in fact it's immediate. So those requesting the data can pay for the translation or transformation. That's certainly an idea that existed earlier on. So that might be those requesting it or those needing it pay, something like that. All right, and then we have scale. So why transform all the data rather than just the ones that happen to be of interest at the moment? So actually, again, in earlier versions, this concept was there. So, I think we really may want to add something about ad hoc, just having some kind of organ that would transform if it was necessary for a particular purpose. So one thing I'd just like to pick up is actually we have to be careful about not oversimplifying our arguments, because often it's quite easy to say, oh, these are arguments for mandatory transformation or against mandatory transformation, but actually it's more complicated. On the against mandatory transformation side, in fact, it's not saying that it should never happen. It's saying that there may be situations where it is necessary for it to happen, at that point, there needs to be more work to indicate exactly how that would happen. So, that just connects, I think. Emily, would you like to pick up something there?
Just to say, I think I didn't... So my reading of these are comments that others made rather than my own, but I didn't read that second comment as a suggestion that that there should be some sort of mandatory rule that there should be transformation on the fly, rather that tools exist. There are automated translation and transliteration tools out there that could do that very efficiently on an ad hoc basis. And what we would need to be doing is exploring whether that system is sufficiently efficient, if you like, to satisfy the needs without reinventing it within the contracted party's environment, I think. So, in other words, we're saying, well, okay, people who have the need for transformation of this data, can they not simply do that themselves on an ad hoc basis outside of the ICANN environment? What is the need for it to be placed into the ICANN environment?
Thank you very much. That's an interesting refinement. So I think certainly until now the presumption always was that if there were something ad hoc occurring, it would be inside the environment, but maybe it was just that, a presumption that shouldn't have been made. I take your point. Ad hoc and not necessarily within ICANN, yes. But, Amar, would you like to pick up something on that?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. This is Amar. I just wanted to say that I certainly agree with this point, and I agree with Emily's reading of it. And I would also like to point out that it does help us answer another question that we were asked on who do we believe should carry the burden of the cost. And in this case, under this model, if there was an ad hoc transformation of contact data occurring on a case-to-case basis, then that would pretty much mean that we are recommending that mandatory transformation does not occur, and that we are recommending that the cost or the burden of any transformation be placed on the entity or person requesting the transformation rather than on registrants, registrars, or registries. Thanks.
Thank you. That's an interesting point. I think that we'd probably have to overtly state that, but yes, I think that that would seem to work as a model and actually link ad hoc to those to entity requesting. Yes. Now, coming back to the end point of this second point. We've got the sentence, status quo is several orders of magnitude more efficient, we may want to disagree with that comment, because although in a sense it may be more efficient in some meanings of the expression, it's also not doing as much as what we hope a replacement system will do. So, that's really the sort of. I don't think I will pick that up. When updating things, Amar, would you like to say something there?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. And I just wanted to ask, are you on the third point, accuracy and responsibility?
No, I'm still on the last sentence of number two. So I'm talking about the status quo is several orders of magnitude more efficient, and I'm just about to go into the next bit.
Okay, apologize. Thanks.
Okay, no problem. Right, okay. So So then we're on who accepts responsibility if registrars are required to alter those data. Okay. I think that as soon as you have transformation, whether it's mandatory or not, you start getting difficult questions. And the way I read it is that the responsibility is on registrants, but I would be very interested to see what people say to that. Okay, so and then we got to talk about proposals impacting who is data accuracy complaints. But yes, Emily, would you like to pick something out?
Just offering a point of view on that. I think that's right. Ultimately, it is the registrant's responsibility for the data, and I think that this sort of highlights one of the interesting and challenging issues of this is that if you have somebody who is entering who is data in a non-Latin script, the chances are that they may not have the skills or the capacity to check that any transformation is accurate. So that there's a capacity issue there. But there's also, if it's automatically done by the registry or registrar, then that is a third party sort of just intervening, making an intervention and transforming that data, perhaps without the registrant's knowledge, and handing the registrant the responsibility for that. And of course, as we know, the responsibility for accurate data, if it turns out to be inaccurate, could lead to the cancellation or suspension of the domain name. So this is quite it sort of goes to the core of the contractual relationship. It's also an area where I think that contracted parties, registries and registrars would be hesitant to go to, because if they're starting to kind of mess around make these changes, then there is, query whether they are assuming risks or potentially opening themselves up to liability if it all goes wrong. Mm-hmm. So I think it is a complex area. I just thought you asked for some feedback on that. That's how I'm understanding that's quite a complex area. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. It's picked up in greater detail further down. Transformation almost becomes a euphemism. It's transformation or adding something which, the feeling really is that the thing is starting slightly to get out of control. Something is being added. Sort of transformation almost messing up. Okay. Now, Amar has been picking up a couple of points in the chat room, and so he's suggesting that we could add something on this now, and it's the first bullet on page 12 where that could go. Okay. Oh, yes. Okay. So, yes, that does look like a logical place to put that. Okay. And let us return and see what else we have to have a look at here. Okay, so we're now... So how would the proposals impact who is data accuracy complaints and who is verification requirements? So the verification requirements end up being much more complicated. That's my gut instinct on that part of it. So I guess the complaints are going to largely become a problem for registrants under that sort of model. Okay. And perhaps we can then move down to point four on data integrity. Who should be displaying what the client entered? Our trying to interpret. That's another possible euphemism, isn't it? Our trying to interpret that only leads to more data errors, less accurate data. This is hugely interesting. In fact, oddly enough, I wrote a note to myself that this could be added to the same bullet point. So, yes, we're on the same wavelength there. Okay. Then into the various sub-points. Amr, would you like to pick up something at this point?
Yes, thanks, Chris. This is Amr. Just on the last sentence in point three, mm-hmm. as well as the point four of data integrity, I would advise, of course, that this working group recommends that regardless whether transformation of data is mandatory or not, that the authoritative set of contact information always remain as the original data provided by the registrant in their native language and script, just to avoid issues of who is verification requirements and everything else. So the authoritative set will always be the one provided in the native language and script, and it is that contact information that should be verified and validated. Thanks.
Thank you. There is something in the document on this subject. I will double check that it reflects what you've just been saying, but there is some text there. I'd struggle to find it quickly, but I think that is still in the document, but I will check that it is still strong enough. Okay, so then off we go into the sub-points of number four. So will there be rules on how to transliterate non-ASCII characters? We've spent a lot of time suggesting what the rules could be, but I think to some extent it actually falls outside the scope of what we're doing. So, personally, this is an area I would really like to get involved in the future because I've got very strong feelings about this. I'm sure lots of us have, having done this. Basically the suggestions we have been making were that that national standards should be used, and even saying that there are problems because there are countries with more than one standard, so you have to decide which one you're going to use. Also, even worse, there are countries which don't have a standard, so then you're having to use a standard for the script, and if you have to do that, then it can be a nightmare because different languages use different scripts in different ways, and so what is a Z in Urdu is a sort of heavy D in Arabic, and it's just this is a really complicated area. Can it be done programmatically? Sometimes, depending on the script. Is there some standard system to be used? Yes, we've answered that. So sometimes there's one, sometimes there's several, sometimes there are none. Or are we all just counting on Google Translate? Heavens no. I mean, Google Translate is very good for certain languages. It is absolutely horrible for other languages. And also, most of what we were suggesting is transliteration. I mean, the only exceptions to that are the country fields, which would be translated, so you would get something like China. Even the organizational name, I think the last work we did, we were just suggesting that the organization decided how they wanted to transform their organizational name. So, you know, it may well be English in some cases, but, you know, there are certainly many Chinese organizations with no translated English form. So at that point, they may transliterate or do something else. But I think the last thing we said on that was that it should be up to them how they wanted that field to appear. So most of the time, we're talking about transliteration anyway, so you know, Google Translate's not much use. Okay. I got quite excited on that one. I'll just wait a moment to see if anybody wants to pick up anything. Okay. So moving further down, if human judgment is required, who is responsible for doing it? So this specifically refers to the situation where there is no transliteration. Well, two possible situations. It's either that there is no transliteration scheme, which is a nightmare because you then have to create one, or there is no tool that will automatically transliterate, which is quite a common situation. Many languages, there really aren't adequate tools for transliterating. So in that situation, somebody would have to do it manually, and the default situation would be that the registrant would be responsible unless something else is set up. So, I'll just wait for that to sink in. Oh yes, and in fact it's picked up in the next point, which is if the registrant is responsible, which is what I was just suggesting, what if they don't know what it should be? It might be possible to give some guidance. Funnily enough, earlier today I had somebody in my office who spoke another language, and this person was in my office and he didn't actually know how to transliterate his language, but after I'd spoken to him for a bit, that was a language where there were fairly good rules. Usually people learn pretty quickly, but it might be that, you know, typical situations are that in order to represent a sound like long I, sort of E sound like that, a lot of people will write EE, but many transliterations would actually have that as II. It's little things like that. But you could actually set up some sort of resource that would be of help to people. You know, that's certainly within the realms of possibility. So, wiki-like, knowledge base, perhaps. Could be an answer to that. What if a third party disagrees with the accuracy of a transliteration? Well, fundamentally what we're talking about here is the adherence to rules. So basically, if you've got a standard, if it's a good standard, it will actually decide. So you can look at the standard and say, is it adhering to that or not? You could imagine validation systems having problems, because typically when there is a difference between transliteration, you're just talking a couple of letters either side. So the example I gave a moment ago, we might have two E's where really ideally we'd want two I's. So if you have a system which is a little bit tolerant and will accept things which are slightly wrong, then you're doing much better than if you have a validation system which just completely reject something over some minor error. But on the other hand, I suppose you could say that, you know, often some minor difference might be enough to cause a lot of confusion and trouble. Okay. Just have a quick look at the chat room, because I can see Amma's typing something. So Amma is saying his name is transliterated in different ways, yeah. So I guess that a lot of people are wanting to put a vowel before the M and the R there, because English usually does that. Yes, that's a nice example. Right. Moving slowly down. Is the registrant's consent required before a transliteration is published in the Whois? I would suggest the answer is no. I think effectively, I wouldn't have thought that this would be data that we would want to hide, put behind some kind of protection. Watching for possible responses to that. And Emily is giving some lovely examples. Oh, yes. Okay, so, yep. Here we have a combination of the sorts of transliterations which are probably adhering to some standards, and then you just have some really idiosyncratic ones as well. Luckily, with individual names, our suggestions would have been that basically, really, the individual is the person who decides how that name's going to appear. And the example I give there is that, you know, looking at various things, people may think that I'm Christopher Dillon or Christopher J. Dillon or Christopher James Dillon or Chris James Dillon. There are so many possibilities. The right answer is actually Chris Dillon. I was born Christopher Dillon, but actually I'm really Chris Dillon. That's the one I use, and I'm the guy who decides that. That's certainly the approach that a library would take. And so, you know, there are occasions where libraries actually have to write letters to authors and ask them, who are you? Okay, and then there's something that Emma is saying about confusion. Oh, yeah. So you could also have things which actually end up becoming different names. Elsa, Ailsa, Elsie, these are names which are quite close, but, you know, just a slight difference in the vowel. There's a lot in a name. Okay. Emily, would you like to pick something up?
Yes, just to raise an issue here about the general sort of level of involvement of the parties in creating a domain name record. I think that we have to, you know, we're interested in this stuff, and, you know, by definition, being on this working group, we're very interested in transformation. But, you know, experience suggests that getting registrants to be interested at all in the quality of their data, even in their own language, is quite a challenge. To get them to click on a validation email, I mean, we were hearing in the London ICANN meeting that is not going very smoothly in some cases. And I just wanted to kind of, you know, challenge ourselves with a reality check on sort of how likely is it that we are going to train all of the registrants in the world to respect and take on board some fairly complicated standards for transliteration into a language they may not, or a script they may not even be familiar with. So it's just a really a note of caution on that. Interesting though it is, and interesting, you know, I'm very interested in your insights into this, Chris, of course. So that was what I wanted to say. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I guess a library may be one of the few areas where people, you know, were paid, less so these days actually, to look at data very, very carefully. This is a completely different situation from what we're talking about. And I agree completely. Trying to get people to be interested in this is a massive problem. I'm not sure we've actually picked this up to an adequate extent, and heaven knows we've picked up so many aspects, but you know, just the motivational thing here is a real killer, because unless you have some way of motivating people to want to do something, your chances of success are really quite low. So yes, I mean, it's it's another, it certainly is a major facet to this, and we have a duty to try and make suggestions, but there are occasions where one almost feels as if one is being asked to do the impossible. It is just so hard. And moving further down, can a registrant withhold consent? Now, this is something, I'll be honest with you, I don't know very much about. I believe the answer is yes. So there are legitimate cases where registrants are able to hide their identity and a proxy is used. Now, that's really, from my perspective, it's just sort of general knowledge. I believe that is the case. I am really happy to be corrected by somebody else. I'm outside my area, really. Amr, would you like to add something to that?
Thanks, Chris. I believe, and I'm also open to being corrected, but I believe that if a registrant wishes to use a privacy and or proxy service to keep his or her or its identity hidden in the WHOIS database, it doesn't mean that transformation of the contact information wouldn't happen. It would just mean that this information would also be hidden. So I don't think it would mean that the registrant could withhold consent on the transformation occurring. It would just mean that this transformed data would possibly also be behind a proxy. Thanks.
Thank you very much. That is, and Petter is agreeing with you in the chat room. That makes that much clearer. But withhold agreement from transformation. Okay, moving further down, what if a registrant wants to change an approved transliteration? I think I picked this up earlier on, so I think there is a whole thing about transliteration where it isn't completely black and white. I mean, typically you get lots of wavering over a digit or so. You know, one character may be changed for another, or there may be a hyphen or something like that. So what if the registrant wants to change it? One comment I would make is okay, but as long as it's bringing it closer to the standard. There is then a follow-up question. Is a WHOIS verification required every time one of these fields is updated? Yes, I think so, because although the change may be small, it's still a change, and it would still need to come under that. I guess there is a possibility that a small change could be enough to change it into something else, at which point verification would be necessary. Okay. Then further down, where does the requirement for data transformation end? Ah, yes, now. If I've understood it correctly, I think this may actually be a relatively easy question. There had to be one. This came up before at one point, and the conclusion was that we are talking very much about transforming from non-Roman scripts into ASCII. And in fact, as I said earlier on, most of the time we're transliterating from non-Roman scripts into ASCII. So we're not, we're not doing any other kind of. Yes, I mean theoretically there are all kinds of possible transformations, but effectively, nearly always we are talking about transliterating from non-Roman into ASCII. Very occasionally, the country names may well be a translation, but they may be the only exception. All right, and then we're on to a bit further down, just checking you can see things. Okay, so we've got something on compliance, number 5. Who will and how will this be policed? And there's even a suggestion that it could be ICANN. Yes, and then the idea that this could well end up costing more for the registrants. Yes, this is something we visited a little earlier. ICANN simply doesn't have the technical ability to do this stuff, so that isn't really an option unless they, they acquire the capability. These are all questions that I think other groups would need to answer, and we may have strong feelings and say, well, if you're going to do this, then we might want to suggest about how that might be done, but Amr, would you like to pick up something there?
Thanks, Chris. This is Amr. Just to point out that ICANN does have a contractual compliance team that does check on WHOIS accuracy, I believe, every year, and provides statistics on how well WHOIS accuracy is being maintained.
Mm-hmm.
If this does become a policy, then I assume that the same contractual team would carry out these functions, which would probably add yet another layer of costs to what making this workable. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, that's a much better answer than the one I just gave. There is that existing team. What they would need to do would be to hire a network of linguists who would be able to check every major world language. That is a large expense. Not a small thing at all. Not impossible, but quite expensive to check every language. Okay. So we've picked up the thing on higher charges. Into the next one on internationalization. And this is quite interesting because it's bringing up an ICANN principle. So my language, my internet, and the claim that the concept is starting to erode that, compelling the use of English or Latin or ASCII. Sadly, it is North American thinking. We must translate everything into English. Now, this is going to be a surprising moment during our calls when Chris Dillon actually gets to defend the English language. Well, not quite, but I've spent many, many years learning other languages. I feel that this is going too far. So if there is going to be transformation, the idea that we would pick a simple alphabet, 26 letters. It doesn't get much more simple. We're not really, it's certainly not English. And, you know, as we've said before, we are hardly translating. If there is going to be transformation, I would say ASCII makes huge sense. And yeah, I would really struggle to be able to make what alternatives could there be? IPA, the International Phonetic Alphabet, but it's much larger than ASCII, and a lot of people don't know it. I feel this one's going too far. I think if there is a group which requires transformation, then ASCII is the way to go. So for once, I'm going to rebuff that one. All right. Then, number 7, competition. If a contracted party doesn't want to support a language, Yes, this is a sort of an approach which we had in earlier versions of what we've been working on, and possibly has got a bit lost in this one. So we might want to reinstate this. Okay. So it ends up being something like decide what business you're in and pay for what you're going to use, something like that almost. Amr, would you like to pick up something there?
Hi, this is Amr. When this PDP working group was performing its initial outreach to the community on comments for this PDP, NCSG had something to say on competition, but it wasn't framed exactly like this. It was framed more towards startups for new registrars, for example, that were starting in countries where IDNs were being introduced. It was from a competition perspective, we felt that, the NCSG felt that barrier to entry for some of these contracted parties, if there was a policy like this in place that would force them to incur a cost than they normally would. So that was one aspect of competition that I don't feel is necessarily reflected by this comment, but I thought it might be helpful to
Thank you. So what you're saying is that or maybe this is just a related idea, but the idea that by, you know, if transformation were mandatory, then that could affect competition and make it very difficult for smaller actors. Is it that sort of an idea?
Yeah, that's exactly correct, Chris, and especially for actors or startup registrars from developing countries where they are developing a market for internationalized domain names, and when their clients wouldn't necessarily be English speakers or users of Latin-based script, and where they would just prefer to register the domain names in their local language and script, but then this registrar would have to pay to have this data transformed, and that would be a significant cost for a new startup in a developing country. Thanks.
Thank you very much indeed. In my opinion, that is the strongest argument against mandatory transformation, and it is reflected in the document. Okay, then we're into the, I better be a bit strategic here, because before going into general comments and further down, I've realized the hour has gone very quickly today, so I'll just ask quickly whether anybody has any other business before we use the remaining minutes of the call on other things. Okay, Amr, would you like to pick something up?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. This is Amr again. A few weeks ago, I had suggested that we try to find a middle ground as opposed to looking at the recommendations of this PDP working group as a sort of a binary issue. It's either yes or no. And one scenario I came up with was to recommend that transformation is not mandatory at this point, but since there is so little supporting data to justify mandatory transformation, perhaps part of our recommendation could include that future studies be done once this is becoming more of an issue. So just to look at it and see and take a closer look at it using empirical data that does not exist now. I was wondering if this might be a form of a middle ground between these two recommendations of yes or no, and whether that might be something, for example, the IPC might be willing to look at. Thanks.
Okay. Yes. This is you know, certainly a very interesting approach. There is certainly a possibility that we could conceivably say something like transformation shouldn't be mandatory, but other work should be done for the cases when if there are cases when it is necessary. However, there is a situation whereby I've completely lost the track of my thought. These things happen. Okay, so Petter has just running out of time. So Petter, would you like to say something?
Just a very quick comment. If you want a quick answer to that question, it will be a no. But still, if you could send out again as proposed mixed of these new comments, I promise to take it back to IPC and also discuss it with other IP groups. To see what we can come up with. Thanks.
Thank you, Patrick. Yes, I'll certainly do that after the meeting. I've remembered what my additional thought was, and that is that we have further comments in the pipeline. So there are comments coming from the legal community next week. I hope they're in time for the meeting. So the bottom line on that one is that this story is not yet over. There may be other things that we just don't know about. So once we've had those comments in from the legal community and other and related comments, then we can be more sure of where we are. But until that's happened, we can't be. I was going to say entirely sure. I don't think we'll be entirely sure there, but never mind. Okay, so I'm just going to pick up a few things in the chat room. Yes. In fact, funnily enough, Emily is picking up this concept of further research into the extant. And in fact, that is a fairly good summary of much of the rest of the things we would have done today if we'd had enough time. I would really like to encourage you after the call to have a look at some of the other comments. Everything's in the wiki. And this is really the key area. So to what extent do we know the extent, to what extent do we have statistics about the need for languages? What is the scale of this problem? And the short answer, as far as I know, is that we have very little, and it may be necessary to commission further research. But that's just a very quick comment on what is quite a long piece of text. But I'll say that just to hopefully to awaken your interest in this. That might go some way to suggesting what else is in this particular comment, and there are a couple of smaller comments as well. I think three of them altogether, but with a good wind, we should be able to cover those and possibly a rather longer comment from the legal community next week. All right. Well, we're at the top of the hour, and I think this may be a good time to round off because, you know, otherwise we are heading into other things. So perhaps we can leave it for this week and perhaps continue some things on the mailing list. And I will work on a new draft, which will include, I hope, reflections from last week's discussion and this week's discussion. I will do my best. You've probably heard me taking notes as we've been speaking. I've been really trying very hard to get it all down, but it may be that I come back to it and can't read my own writing, so if that happens, I beg for forgiveness. Okay, and people saying some rather nice things in the chat room. Well, it's been a pleasure to go through the comments because they've been extremely helpful to us. Just hang on for a few more minutes. Okay, well, in that case, thank you very much for today and, you know, for what's been a very interesting discussion. I look forward to another one next week and have great weeks until then. Goodbye then.
Damon, if you can please stop the recording. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining. Have a great rest of your day and please remember to disconnect all remaining lines.